There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now, let me welcome to Eye on Health. Real pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. David Robertson, Group Medical Director and Consultant in Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Suzanne. Good afternoon.
It's good to have you back here and bringing your wealth of experience and expertise to help people. People that are struggling to get pregnant, couples that are finding that to be a challenge. And it can be such a stressful time for couples. And what we're looking at today is maybe you've had a baby, but it's actually second time and not falling pregnant the second time. So it has a term. It's the secondary infertility phase. So is this a common thing, doctor?
Yes, it's just as common as primary infertility, to be honest. And in some way, there's an extra pressure, because once you've had a child, most people do want to have more than one child. And after a couple of years, the child that you have usually starts to add in some pressure, saying they want a little brother or sister. So it's definitely a common problem.
Why is it? If you've been pregnant once, fertility has been fine between a couple, how is it that it starts to not be working?
Well, circumstances change sometimes. I mean, we're assuming here that somebody has got pregnant and had a baby without any kind of medical intervention. It's just all happened naturally. But sometimes things go wrong. People develop problems. For example, a man's sperm count can change over the years, not necessarily because he's getting older, although there are that can happen to some extent. But he may develop illnesses, he may develop problems, and the same thing can happen to the woman. One thing that is particularly relevant is that when somebody is pregnant and then delivers the baby, or if they have a miscarriage, occasionally problems arise at that time. For example, pelvic infections can occur after delivery or after a miscarriage, and that will occasionally lead to problems with the fallopian tubes in the woman, so that she then has difficulty conceiving a second time.
And when we're looking at options, and obviously you specialise in IVF, and when we're looking at that, you know, marking World IVF Day, there is such a thing. It was back in July, and marking the birth of the first IVF baby, Louise Brown. I kind of remember that in the UK. It was such a big story all over the press at the time, and I was very young, but I remember it. And yeah, so it was all due to the work of the founders of the Bourne Hall Fertility Centre. So tell us a little bit about that, when it happened, and Louise Brown, and sort of, I suppose, the sort of science behind it, really.
Well, Louise Brown was born in 1978, and I remember it well also, because I just graduated the year before in medicine, and I was just starting my career in obstetrics and gynecology, and it was one of the things that really fascinated me at the time. But the two doctors that were responsible for that live birth, Patrick Steptoe, who was a gynecologist, and Bob Edwards, a physiologist at Cambridge University in the UK, they had been working on this for a number of years, as indeed had many other people throughout the world. And Louise Brown's mother was about the 100th patient that had had embryos put back inside her uterus. So they had done this many, many times without it being successful. They managed to collect eggs from women. They managed to fertilize the eggs with the sperm. But the trick was getting the embryo to actually stick inside the uterus. And that was quite a long, arduous pathway before finally a successful birth occurred. There were some pregnancies before that, but unfortunately, these either miscarried or they were located in other places outside the uterus, what are known as ectopic pregnancies.
So IVF, it's in vitro fertilisation. I'm looking at the NHS site here. I know you can explain it eloquently, but I'm just interested to see how it is explained. It's one of several techniques available to help people with fertility problems have a baby. So during IVF, an egg is removed from the woman's ovaries and fertilised with sperm in a laboratory. And the fertilised egg, called an embryo, is then returned to the woman's womb to grow and develop. It can be carried out using your eggs and your partner's sperm or eggs and or sperm from donors. donors. But there are sort of versions of this, if you will. So, you know, let's establish first off, second time around, wanting to get pregnant, it's not happening. Going to see your OB/GYN or going to see a specialist, at what point is it deemed there is maybe an issue, as in you could intervene with this fertility process?
Well, really, we would follow the same criteria as we would do in somebody who's trying to get pregnant for the first time, in that you have to allow a certain amount of time for nature to take its course. So that will depend on a number of factors. It will depend on the woman's age, for example, is very important. And once somebody's had a baby and then they're trying again for another baby, they're often a bit older, of course. So you have to try for a reasonable period of time. And the textbook definition, if you like, is to actually try regularly for a pregnancy for about a year before one might consider that there's likely to be a problem of some kind and some tests would be necessary. But that's flexible. In a woman who's in her late 30s, getting up towards 40 or over, it's probably prudent to actually start some tests a bit earlier than that, because her chance of conceiving will be a bit less.
So with your practice here in the UAE, Bourne Clinic, how long have you been here? How long has Bourne Clinic been here?
The clinic's been here since 2012. We opened to patients in 2012.
And what do you offer? Is it just IVF?
No, we offer IVF and variations around that theme. We offer a treatment known as intrauterine insemination. And then some patients don't actually require very much in the way of high-tech interventions. The woman may just need some medication to help her regulate her periods and release an egg every month. Now, those things are very often handled by regular gynecologists, and a lot of women will have a doctor that they see for checkups on a regular basis, and they'll often carry out that kind of treatment. But there are patients that come directly to us simply because they're not conceiving.
Dr. David Robertson, Group Medical Director and Consultant of Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic. From Glasgow, or from Scotland. You went to the University of Glasgow, I believe, back in the 70s. And where are you from originally? Is it Glasgow?
I'm from Glasgow originally.
You are, yeah. A lot of doctors come from that fine city.
A lot of doctors come from Scotland.
Yes,
the best doctors are Scottish.
And of course, working in the field of IVF, joined Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic in early 2011 and was closely involved in the development of their flagship centre here in Dubai. When we're looking at the UAE and infertility or fertility issues, looking at media here, press saying guidance offered to couples facing fertility issues, one in five couples in the UAE, that's what it's being stated in that article. I know that Bourne Hall have done their own studies as well. So is that you think that's an accurate figure? One in five couples?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, the figure that's usually quoted worldwide is about one in six. And there are a number of problems in the UAE which I think make the problem a little bit more common. So I think one in five is a reasonable estimate.
So what would they be? Lifestyle?
I think lifestyle's got a lot to do with it. What we see two particular situations here in the UAE. On the woman's side, there's a condition known as polycystic ovaries, which is very, very common. Now, that's not necessarily related to lifestyle. There are other issues. There's a genetic component to it as well. And on the male side, sperm problems, and in fact, complete absence of sperm, is quite common here. It's probably more common than I would see in the UK, for example. And certainly 50 to 60% of the couples that we see coming through the clinic, it's a sperm-related issue on the husband's side.
And that can be, there's many reasons why that might be, but it could be to do, if it's lifestyle, it could be to do with smoking, could be to do with obesity.
Yeah, smoking, obesity, alcohol, poor diet. Yes, I mean, all the things we love to do wrong in Dubai, unfortunately.
Yeah, it could be impacting fertility. Let me share this with you. This is for about a woman called Sarah. From the outside, she seems that she has it all. Sarah has it all, a job in finance, a devoted husband and a beautiful four-year-old daughter. But she's hiding a painful secret. For 3 years, she has tried and failed to conceive a second child. We got pregnant almost straight away with our daughter, explained Sarah. So we assumed it would be just as easy the second time around. However, when that didn't happen, Sarah got increasingly concerned. My best friend and her son had her son around the same time I had my daughter. We didn't plan to be pregnant at the same time. It just happened that way. When she got pregnant with her second son, I felt a rising panic that it wasn't happening to me. She's now given birth to her second son and is talking about having a third, and I'm grieving because I won't have had that. As well as the pain of longing for a second child, Sarah's had to deal with comments from strangers, everyone from the woman in the supermarket to my mother-in-law asking me when I'm going to get a move on and give my daughter a brother or sister, from people saying or thinking that, you know, why aren't you happy with the one that you've got? Why would you want, you know, if you're not having a second one, then, you know, kind of move on from that. You don't have to have a second one because you've already got the first one. And that's, I think, an easy thing for somebody to say who's not been in that position. If you feel that you want to have a baby and you're not able to have one, you can't take away the how debilitating that must feel for that individual. So that must be what you're kind of facing on a daily basis with couples. Is that right?
That's right. And of course, there's personal distress with the couples, but it's exacerbated by pressure from family, from friends. And as you mentioned there, perhaps well-meaning individuals who ask about when are you going to have a second one without realising. And people don't really mean to hurt your feelings, but of course it happens because they're not aware what's going on in your life. So yes, it's a constant struggle for many of these people.
It says here that Sarah's not alone. Secondary infertility affects a growing number of couples. In fact, it now counts for 3 out of 5 fertility cases. However, the condition defined as the inability to conceive or carry to term a second or subsequent child is rarely discussed and under research, and it comes with a unique stigma, the perception that you should be happy with the one that you have. So this is what we're addressing today. Has this affected you? You had your first child, it was fairly straightforward as you wanted it, but second time around it's been a stumbling block, it's not happening, you've had fertility issues, maybe you've gone down the IVF route. Now when a couple comes to see you, doctor, is it because you're a fertility clinic, you specialise in IVF, is it always about having IVF or are other things considered as well?
No, it really depends on the nature of the problem. You know, with that in mind, I would mention that actually in quite a high proportion, perhaps 25% of couples, you carry out all the tests and you can't find an obvious problem. And of course, that is extra frustrating for these people. But no, we would investigate a couple in this position in exactly the same way as somebody who's already, who's not had a child already. Although perhaps we would concentrate a little bit more on issues that can arise after childbirth. And I mentioned before, if somebody's had a problematic delivery, then perhaps we would look more closely at the possible consequences of that. Pelvic infection, blocked fallopian tubes, for example.
Okay. And so when it's decided, the couple decide they want to go ahead with IVF, is there anyone that can't have IVF first?
Well, there are some individuals where it can be difficult. And I mentioned before polycystic ovaries, which is very common here amongst Gulf Arab women in particular. Now, these women can be very, very sensitive to the medication that's given in IVF. But we can adjust that. We can avoid using powerful stimulating drugs and therefore reduce the risk that they face sometimes of overstimulating the ovaries. Then there are some women who are a bit older, or the ovaries are not working as well as they should be, and they don't really respond to the medication, and it's difficult to get them to produce eggs. And if we can't get eggs from somebody, unfortunately, we're not able to offer them IVF treatment.
Okay, so the first steps then, if somebody wants to go down that route, you've had the tests, you've gone through all of the options, and this seems like a good option for this particular couple, what would be the first step?
If we're proceeding with IVF treatment and we've completed all the tests, then the timing of treatment really revolves around the woman's menstrual cycle. There are 2 or 3 different ways of doing it, but broadly speaking, what you need to do is to give the woman medication to stimulate her ovaries so that she will produce a number of eggs. And these drugs are usually given by injection, but there are tablets that can be given sometimes. And the injections are given usually for around 10 or 11 days following the onset of a period. They also usually have to have additional medication which prevents the woman from releasing the eggs before they reach maturity, which is a problem we used to face back in the early days when I started, and these drugs weren't available. But once we have a group of what are called follicles on the ovaries, now these are like cyst-like structures on the ovaries that contain the eggs, and we can follow their development on regular ultrasound scans. So once these reach a mature size after 10 or 11 days, we then have to carry out a small operation to actually collect the eggs from the woman. And this is normally done by passing a needle from below under a mild anaesthetic into the ovaries, collecting the eggs. And at the same time, the husband will provide us with a semen sample. And then the IVF laboratory can put the sperm and the eggs together in the way that's appropriate for this particular couple.
And all of this is done here in the UAE?
Yes, there are a number of clinics in the UAE that can offer this.
Okay, and then what?
So once the laboratory has the sperm and the eggs, they will put them together. And there's a couple of different ways of doing that. Sometimes you are really just literally putting them together in a dish, and the sperm will fertilize some of the eggs. If the sperm quality is very poor, then sometimes it's necessary to actually inject a single sperm directly into each egg. And that's a treatment that's known as ICSI, I-C-S-I. Intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And that has really revolutionized our management of severe male factor infertility, where men have very, very low sperm counts. But once we've achieved fertilization of at least some of the eggs, we then have some embryos. And these embryos can then grow and divide and develop over the next few days. And the ideal really is to grow them through to about 5 days or so after the eggs have been collected, because the embryos should follow a certain pattern of development, and we can gauge their quality to some extent by checking to see that they do follow that pattern, that they keep growing up to this stage, and that then allows us to pick the best ones to replace back into the woman. So that would be done ideally after 5 days. But there are occasions when the embryos would be put back earlier than that if the number is very small or we're concerned that they may not keep developing in the laboratory.
Okay. And then you wait?
And then you wait, yes. And that's the worst part of treatment. I think it's all very well having 10 or 11 days worth of injections, but then just waiting to see if a pregnancy has resulted is, of course, very, very difficult. The woman is usually taking medication at this point to help support the embryos, but nonetheless, there's very little else that she's doing other than waiting.
Mm. And the drugs that she's taking, is that going to cause any other effects or side effects or...
The husbands do mention these things to me occasionally in passing. What we're really doing is mimicking what happens in a natural cycle. So there's a hormone that's normally produced after a woman ovulates naturally, and we have to give that hormone to help support any pregnancy that might result. And that's the hormone which probably is responsible for premenstrual tension. So I think there's a lot of things go on emotionally. Obviously, there are hormonal effects, but also people are anxious. They're waiting to see if it's worked. They're scared to exercise. They're scared to move around too much in case the embryos fall out.
And this has come after possibly a long period of trying to get pregnant naturally.
That's right.
And there's a cost involved as well. So there's a lot of things going on.
There's a lot of things hanging on it, yes. Yeah.
So Susan's asking, would you look at IUI as a procedure prior to doing IVF as an option, as it can get expensive with IVF?
IUI, or intrauterine insemination, is an option for some people. It's a simpler form of treatment which involves putting a prepared sample of the husband's sperm inside the uterus, sometimes, but not always, after giving small doses of the stimulating medication. And the reason I say small doses is that with IUI, we're not controlling how many eggs there are or how many embryos might develop. So you don't really want somebody ovulating 5 or 6 eggs, because they might end up with 5 or 6 babies all at the same time, which is not really a good thing. But if the woman, if there's no obvious reason for the infertility, if the woman has open fallopian tubes and everything seems to be functioning normally, and the sperm count is more or less normal, or there's just a mild abnormality with the sperm, then IUI can be an appropriate treatment. It's not as successful as IVF, but it's much, much easier. And on a private basis, it's far less costly as well.
More to come about IVF and secondary infertility, and questions and comments coming in. One here from somebody saying, I've been through IVF twice. When I gave up, I fell pregnant naturally. My dear friend has been through it for the last 11 years. The question is, when do you actually decide that you're not meant to have children? That's a big area to discuss. And also people that have had, one gentleman here, sperm count has been affected due to cancer in early life. So lots to discuss.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We are talking about infertility, well, really secondary infertility, those fertility issues, had a baby, not falling pregnant second time around, and we're exploring IVF and marking World IVF Day, which was last month. It marks the birth of the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, thanks to the work of the founders of the Bourne Hall Fertility Centre. And joining us here is Dr. David Robertson, Group Medical Director and Consultant in Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic here in the UAE. And you're just talking us through the process of going through IVF and the waiting game to see if it's worked and that you've fallen pregnant. We're going to go into what happens if you haven't fallen pregnant after the first round and what the options are. But to share some of the messages that have come in, one here saying, I'm a 31-year-old male. When I was 14, I went under chemotherapy due to bone cancer, and it affected my testosterone and levels and sperm production. I've taken HCG injections for 6 months, and thankfully, they found 7 sperms and the IVF was successful. So congratulations to you. My question to the doctor is, what is the best way to stimulate the cells to produce more sperm?
Well, that's a great story. I mean, 7 sperm. I mean, just to put that into perspective, a normal sperm count is in the millions. A normal ejaculate might have 50 or 60 million sperm in it. And this is actually the big advantage of this ICSI treatment that I mentioned earlier on, where we can inject a single sperm into the eggs. But cancers of anything really, but also testicular cancers are quite common in young men, unfortunately. And the treatment may render people infertile or subfertile. Now, sometimes there can be an element of recovery after a number of years, but many times they'll be left with a hormone deficiency, or they'll be left with cell damage in the testicles so that they don't produce sperm. So there are times when hormonal replacement, if you like, can rectify the problem to some extent. Not always. There are occasions where it won't achieve anything. So there isn't really a best way. It depends on the exact case. It depends on which hormone is deficient or which one is going to actually rectify the problem that that particular individual is facing. But HCG injections are quite commonly given for situations where a man has a significantly reduced sperm count.
And also, when it comes to age, is there any age limit to having IVF? So presumably, you know, one of the reasons why people might go down the IVF route is because maybe they're older, maybe they're, you know, clearly, you know, their bodies are changing. Is there any age limit?
Well, age is the single most important determinant of the likelihood of success of treatment. And the reason for that is because a woman's egg supply diminishes, unfortunately, as she gets older. So there does come a point where the egg supply finishes, and ultimately the periods will finish at the time of the menopause. Now, the average age of the menopause is around 50 years. But for a number of years before that, the egg supply is diminishing, egg quality is diminishing, and pregnancy becomes much more difficult. I do see women who come in their late 40s, even early 50s, who want to try and achieve a pregnancy. And it's a spectrum really ranging from very, very difficult through to impossible. Now, if somebody has actually stopped their periods and they've gone through the menopause, then there isn't really anything that we can do to rejuvenate the ovaries and to stimulate egg production. In women who still have a cycle, who still have some eggs, and this can mean people in their late 40s, it may be possible. But the success rates are very, very low because a high proportion of eggs at that point are genetically abnormal. They may not fertilize. They may not produce viable embryos. So the chance of achieving a pregnancy can be very, very small. It really comes down to statistics balanced against the effort that is required to try and collect those eggs.
Can you use frozen eggs? Actually, one of our listeners has texted in saying, is it okay to use eggs frozen 3 years ago? This person's 36 years of age. She says by ICSI.
Yes, ICSI is the sperm injection process that I mentioned earlier. Egg freezing is becoming more common. We freeze eggs sometimes where we've collected a large number from somebody going through an IVF cycle, or sometimes we freeze eggs for an individual who wants to preserve their fertility. And that can be for social reasons, because they haven't found Mr. Right yet and they're concerned about their age. Or it can be also in a cancer situation, women that are going to be undergoing some kind of treatment that might impact on their fertility might elect to freeze eggs. Now, in the UAE, we're permitted to freeze eggs, and we can store them for up to 5 years. So these eggs can certainly be used for somebody to try and achieve a pregnancy at the time that's right for them. The pregnancy rates are probably not quite as good as fresh eggs and fresh embryos, but they're getting better all the time, and they're getting very close to the normal success rates that we see.
So on that note, success rate. So you've talked us through the process of going through a round of IVF. The wait is up, and hopefully it's going to be successful. What is the success rate of one round of IVF? Obviously depending, I guess, on the couple and the age and all of these factors.
Well, I think the first thing you have to be very clear about is, what do you define as success? Now, in the UAE, we don't actually have any regulations that define how we have to express that. So I could put on the Born Hall website, I could put up statistics saying that 70% of our patients get pregnant. And that might reflect the number of patients that have a positive pregnancy test. Unfortunately, some of these women will subsequently just have their period and will not carry a pregnancy. And this happens in nature as well. Or I could look at the number of people that go on and actually deliver a live, healthy baby at the end of a normal 9-month pregnancy. And that figure is going to be much, much lower. Now, looking worldwide, within UK, USA, Europe, Australia, most of the well-established IVF centres, we would expect to see a live birth rate in the high 40s for women aged 35 and under. And unfortunately, the figure decreases as the woman gets older. And that's largely because of, again, as I mentioned, problems arising in egg quality, genetic abnormalities with the egg.
Somebody's asking about the effects of having those injections on the woman, and asks about something called mild IVF.
As I mentioned, the drugs are given to stimulate a number of eggs to develop. Now, there are some women where that might be problematic because they overstimulate very easily. And there are some people who simply don't want it because they're concerned about side effects, or they're concerned that there may be long-term consequences. So you can give very small doses of the drugs, or there are tablets that can be given to more gently stimulate the ovaries. The difference there is that we will only end up collecting 2 or 3 eggs, perhaps, or sometimes even just 1 egg. If a woman ovulates normally, you can do a natural cycle and collect the 1 egg that would normally be released in an unstimulated cycle. But the chance of pregnancy then becomes a bit less, because that egg may not fertilize, it may not be a good egg. Next month's egg might be better. So there is an advantage in collecting a number of eggs.
And if it hasn't been successful and you're not pregnant via that round of IVF, what's next? If how do you offer counsel to people? What's the, could you go straight ahead and do it again? Or do you advise people to take a break? What's the sort of general advice? Because people are going to be very upset, right?
Yes, I mean, it's
disappointed and emotional, yeah.
It's very disappointing. It's been a difficult journey anyway, simply physically and mentally going through an IVF cycle. And as you mentioned, there's a cost element as well. So it makes things difficult for people. Now, IVF may be the most appropriate treatment. And if one cycle is not successful, unfortunately, it boils down to statistics. It may well be that another cycle is the best thing for them to do. However, there is a diagnostic side to IVF, and there are occasions where somebody goes through a cycle and we learn something from it. The woman may not respond to the medication in the way that we expect, so therefore we have to adjust something in that regard if they do decide to try again. The eggs may all be of very poor quality, or the embryos may be of poor quality. So sometimes we get some information that then allows us to adjust the next treatment and perhaps increase the likelihood that that might succeed. Now, whether you do that straight away or do it after a bit of a break, I think is a very individual thing. From a medical perspective, there isn't really any reason to delay the treatment in most cases, providing there haven't been any problems that have developed. But I think most people will want to take 1 or 2 months break anyway, just to allow their system to get back to normal.
For the person who said they tried IVF twice and it wasn't successful and decided to stop at that and then fell pregnant naturally, and you do hear about this, don't you?
Yes.
Why, how, why do you think that is?
Well, particularly when we're looking at people with so-called unexplained infertility, where you can't actually find a reason. So if you look at the studies that have been done into particularly younger women under 35 with so-called unexplained infertility, and you follow them over a number of years, many of these people become pregnant. Now, we don't know why they become pregnant after 4 years as opposed to 1 year, but very often no intervention at all is actually needed. But the problem is that people don't generally want to wait that length of time. So IVF is carried out sometimes because somebody needs it from a medical perspective, block tubes, poor sperm, whatever. But it's also performed because people don't want to wait 3 or 4 years before having a successful pregnancy.
Mm. And psychological, you know, stress, emotions can also come into play, can't it?
Yeah, I think. I mean, how do you measure stress?
Yeah.
But yes, I've seen many patients over the years that have had treatment and then fallen pregnant naturally.
Mm. More to come from Dr. Robertson from the Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic. Keep your questions coming in and your stories as well. Have you gone through IVF? Was it successful for you? Are you thinking about it? What are your thoughts? What are your questions? Let us know. Talking to Dr. David Robertson, who's Group Medical Director and Consultant in Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at Bourne Hall Fertility Clinic. We are marking World IVF Day, which was last month. Baby Louise Brown was born back in 1977. Was it, Doctor?
78.
That's right. The first IVF baby. And, you know, it's an option for people. It's fantastic for infertile couples to have an option to have their own baby, to hold that baby in their arms if that's the route you want to go down. But, you know, times are changing, societies are changing, cultures are changing, and how people and when people want to get pregnant, and with the stresses of life as well, it can affect. Let's share this with you. One here, from a gentleman saying, my wife is 39 years of age with very low egg count. Doctor said she can only produce one good egg per each cycle. What's our best chances of getting her pregnant, and is IUI an option?
Well, one would normally only produce one good egg per cycle. And unfortunately, it may not always be a good egg. I assume he's referring to a hormone called anti-Müllerian hormone. And a lot of people have this measured now because it gives an estimate of the egg count, the number of eggs that are left for a woman in her supply. And a lot of people get very upset when they find they have a low egg count. Now, I think the important thing to remember is that this it's about numbers. This just means that the number of eggs is reduced. It doesn't mean the eggs are poor quality. So it may mean that there's a more limited time left in order to achieve a pregnancy. So if somebody has a very low egg count, I think we would usually suggest that they look at treatment options that offer the highest chance of pregnancy. IUI may well be an option if all the other parameters are normal, open fallopian tubes, good sperm count, etc. But statistically, it's less likely to produce a pregnancy than IVF, for example. And depending on how low it is, it may be more sensible to try and undertake a treatment that's more likely to be successful.
And when it comes to two things, actually, IVF, and being successful through a round of IVF and pregnancy. And also somebody's asking about if you have your eggs frozen. So any of these sorts of procedures or I don't know if intervention is the right word, but processes, can it affect the health of the baby? So one person here is saying, is there a higher risk of, say, Down syndrome or autism if you've gone down this road?
No, is the short answer to that. There have been a number of studies over the years looking at the long-term consequences of even repeated cycles of IVF treatment, with no suggestion that there's an increase in genetic abnormalities, for example. There have been one or two studies that have suggested there may be some learning difficulties in some children. But certainly in terms of physical abnormalities or things like autism, there's no evidence of that.
And as a society, are we more infertile than before? Because there's a lot of reports about this suggesting that we are, that, you know, across the globe. I don't know. Some people would argue the point maybe in certain countries. But do you think, as a professional, would you say that today there's more fertility issues than ever before?
I think there probably are, actually. And it's often said, for example, that sperm counts generally are decreasing. And there are a number of studies that show that the proportion of male factor infertility is definitely on the increase. And it's more severe in some countries as opposed to others. But then on top of that, where there's much more awareness about infertility, people are more likely to speak up about it, they're more likely to seek help and then seek treatment if that's available for their particular problem. Whereas in my parents' generation, people would tend to keep quiet about it and suffer in silence, really, because there was very limited availability of treatment.
And people just, were childless. This is a very personal thing. And I think every couple goes down their own route and travels their own path and journey when it comes to fertility and getting pregnant. And for some, they may decide to not continue trying to get pregnant and come to terms with that, and maybe they explore other options or they just remain childless. For those that are going through IVF, and the one person had texted in earlier to say that their friend had spent 11 years, still is going through the process of IVF, it's expensive, and it begs the question, when do you stop? And maybe from a medical, if there's a medical point of view on this, a question to you, doctor, is, when do you say enough is enough and stop going through IVF?
I think that's probably the hardest part of treatment. Interestingly enough, I was actually chatting to an IVF and infertility counsellor last week, and she asked me the question as to what I would consider to be the successful outcome of a counselling session for a patient. And that was the exact example I used, where somebody finds that they're able to stop having treatment. It sounds a terrible thing to say. And of course, we can never say to people, you will never get pregnant. And there are few situations in medicine where the words always and never apply. But if somebody...
Why is that? Because
there's an exception.
They just might. There's the exception to the rule, yeah.
They just might.
Even after all those, that many years, yes. They just might, yeah.
Yes, and I've seen many, many examples of that over the years, particularly if all the tests have been negative. But people get into terrible difficulties sometimes. They spend a lot of money. Their marriages break up because of the friction between the husband and wife over inability to conceive. And this is much more marked in certain cultures where it's automatically assumed it's the woman's fault, and women are divorced and another wife is taken on instead because they can't have children. So the impact on somebody's life can be enormous, and particularly if it goes on for a number of years, financial difficulties can arise and psychological issues arise as well. And I think it's very important that people try to get as much support as they possibly can. Obviously, that will sometimes come from family and from friends, but professional support can also be very, very helpful from the clinic carrying out the treatment, from the doctor, from the nurses, but also from professional counsellors and psychologists. And there does come a time where it may actually be in somebody's best interests to not have any more treatment and to try to move on to accepting that they will not have a child.
The great thing is, since 1978 with IVF, is that there are many, many babies that have been born and made many couples very happy. But it is something you've got to consider taking on, that it might not be successful. And where does that leave you emotionally, practically, as a couple, all the rest of it? So there's a lot to consider. But it's a fascinating area. And I suppose when you're looking at science and medicine, it's got to be one of the most amazing discoveries and progressions, I suppose, when it comes to reproduction. Thank you very much for your time today. It's always a pleasure with you. Dr. David Robertson, Group Medical Director and Consultant in Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at Bournehall Fertility Clinic here in Dubai. All the details are up on our blog post today. For now, Dr. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Suzanne.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.